Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jim Loeb, journalist and founder of Loebblog.com, who discusses Donald Trump's appointment of John Bolton as his national security advisor and the implications for U.S. policy in Iran, Korea, and elsewhere around the world. Excerpts of speeches by students and a teacher at the March for Our Lives rally in Shelton, Connecticut, one of more than 800 events organized on March 24th, demanding the passage of common sense gun regulations. And investigative journalist and author Yasha Levine, who examines charges against Cambridge Analytica for harvesting millions of Facebook profiles in the larger issue of the unregulated collection of personal data for profit. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An advancing Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan has triggered a wave of refugees who are fleeing the conflict. After 4 decades of war, over 2 million Afghans are internally displaced, and Western humanitarian aid agencies are scrambling to address the growing crisis. Increasing numbers of U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan have left residents in rural villages extremely vulnerable, forcing many to leave their homes. In response to the crisis, the Norwegian Refugee Council has increased its aid budget by $30 million to assist displaced Afghans. At the same time, Afghanistan has become a very dangerous place for aid workers. In late 2017, the Red Cross cut back its assistance programs after a series of deadly attacks on their staff. Ironically, the Christian Science Monitor notes, the Taliban capture of new territory has also meant relative peace in some areas, a fragile calm that could be disrupted by an influx of several thousand new U.S. troops deployed by President Trump with orders to fight and win. President Donald Trump and the Koch brothers are backing new measures in Congress to expand the role of private providers at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Veterans groups who support the VA's record on health care are pushing back, asserting that privatization harms veterans who need integrated care. Organizations representing veterans are now teaming up with progressive unions and single-payer advocates to fight privatization. Roberto Clack of the Right to Heal VA campaign says despite management problems, the VA provides quality care for the people who use it. Critics charge that privatization exposes sick veterans to lower quality care, longer wait times, and providers not willing to share medical records with the VA. Privatization, strongly backed by the Koch brothers and others on the right, could threaten 250,000 union jobs at the VA. Thus far, congressional Democrats have been able to block the Trump GOP privatization agenda and the transfer of $2 billion to what's called the Veterans Choice Program that promotes private health care for vets. During the night of October 11, 2012, U.S. Border Patrol officer Lonnie Swartz shot across the Mexican frontier from the border wall in Nogales, Arizona, killing a teenager in Mexico, Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez. Witnesses in Mexico say Rodriguez was peacefully walking down the street the evening he was shot 10 times in the back by Border Agent Swartz. After years of legal wrangling by the Rodriguez family, a U.S. grand jury indicted Swartz for second-degree murder. The case, now on trial in Tucson, Arizona, is the first time a U.S. Border Patrol agent is being prosecuted for a shooting death on the Mexican side of the border. If successful, the case could lead to foreign nationals winning the right to sue the U.S. government for American forces' deadly attacks on civilians in places like Afghanistan. The trial comes as President Trump continues to press Congress to pay for his proposed controversial $20 billion-plus border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The activist group Southern Border Communities Coalition says U.S. border control agents have killed 50 people along the frontier since 2010, where no one has been held accountable. 4 years ago, an independent group, the Police Executive Research Forum, examined the use of deadly force by border agents, criticizing the agency for incidents in which agents opted to shoot at moving vehicles and rock throwers rather than avoid conflict. In those types of low-threat incidents, the group recommended prohibiting agents from responding with deadly force. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
as Donald Trump continued to make major changes to the personnel in his administration, the firing of National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster last week created an opening for a critical position in the White House. That the president decided to fill that vacancy with the appointment of war hawk John Bolton was not so surprising, but was nonetheless greeted with concern and dread in the U.S. and around the world. Bolton, who served as George W. Bush's United Nations ambassador, is well known for his role advocating for the disastrous 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, and more recent calls for a military first strike against North Korea, and a preemptive attack on Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Bolton, a regular commentator on Fox News, has long opposed the 2015 Obama administration-brokered international agreement with Iran that halted the Islamic Republic's nuclear weapons program. With CIA Director Mike Pompeo's recent nomination to succeed fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and Bolton, scheduled to start his new job as National Security Advisor on April 9th, there's widespread speculation that President Trump will decide to pull the U.S. out of the nuclear pact with Iran when he must decide whether or not to waive sanctions against Iran on May 12th. Your reporter spoke with Jim Loeb, the former chief of the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Interpress Service and founder of theloeblog.com. Here he discusses John Bolton's views on the use of military force, as well as the implications for future U.S. policy in Iran, Korea, and elsewhere around the world.
John Bolton is a pretty unique character in that he's kind of the hawk's hawk. He even puts many neoconservatives somewhat on the defensive. He believes strongly in military solutions to political problems. He doesn't like the idea of nation building. And unlike the neoconservatives, he really is not into promotion of democracy, which neoconservatives have always given a great deal of lip service to, although sometimes there's been a failure to back that up, particularly with respect to certain countries that they consider to be allied to the United States. He's very much of an America firster, but he believes the U.S. military should be involved in the world and should be prepared to use force at all times. He's way to the right, very much on the militarism scale, even though he took some considerable efforts to avoid military service during the Vietnam War.
Jim, it seems there's an important date coming up in mid-May where Donald Trump will be on the spot to decide whether to continue on observing the international nuclear agreement with Iran or not. And he certainly sent many signals that he wants to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. What are the repercussions for that nuclear agreement with many other important nations around the world if the U.S. and the Trump administration does decide to pull out?
Well, I think it's a little hard to predict. A great deal depends on the position taken by the major European powers, Britain, France, and Germany, as well as the European Union itself, all of which are parties to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the formal name of the nuclear deal. They were negotiating, that is the what is called the EU3, they were negotiating until last week on possible, quote, fixes, unquote, to the JCPOA. And even then, it wasn't clear that if they went through with those fixes, that Iran itself wouldn't walk away from the agreement, because by its nature, any, quote, fixes, unquote, would violate what was agreed to in 2015 when the JCPOA was concluded. What is likely, what I personally hope, is that the nomination of both Pompeo and the appointment of Bolton will actually make clear to all concerned that the United States is really not serious about fulfilling its commitments to the JCPOA, and that will stiffen their spines. And if they show that they do have spine, that they're willing to counteract any U.S. renunciation of the deal, by counteract, that would mean essentially encouraging their companies to invest in Iran or to sell to Iran, and indicating in no uncertain terms that if the United States does anything with respect to increasing military tensions or actually taking some form of action in the region against Iran, that Europe will not be with them.
Now, the other very concerning policy issue that will be coming to a head quite soon is the planned summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. We're going to have John Bolton whispering in Donald Trump's ear in the lead up to that summit, whenever it actually does occur. There is a lot of danger, is there not, in a failing at that summit, which could lead to greater tensions than we even had before in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. I mean, Trump is uninformed, as we all know. Bolton denounced the idea of any negotiation with North Korea, let alone a presidential summit with North Korea. I don't think anybody knows what to expect, but I think Bolton will try to use this scheduled summit, if it does take place, to say, well, okay, we extended our hand and we didn't get everything we wanted. The North did not agree to denuclearize within a certain amount of time. So now we have to prepare for military action. And again, nobody knows how that's going to turn out, because, of course, North Korea is actually a nuclear armed state with the ability to deliver nuclear weapons far and wide. I mean, the result of Bolton's appointment is, if nothing else, our traditional allies, be they in Western Europe or in Northeast Asia, like Japan and South Korea, are going to distance themselves increasingly from Washington, even just because of Bolton and what he represents and how he's acted in the past. They're pretty frightened by the possible consequences.
That was Jim Loeb, the former Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of Interpress Service and founder of theloeblog.com. For more analysis and commentary on John Bolton's appointment as Trump's new national security advisor, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The March for Our Lives Against Gun Violence drew hundreds of thousands of students and their supporters to Washington, D.C. on March 24th, and to more than 800 other sibling marches across the country, in big cities and small towns, as well as cities abroad. The town of Shelton, Connecticut, organized their own March for Our Lives rally, which drew about 600 people to Veterans Memorial Park on the banks of the Housatonic River. Shelton is just 15 miles away from Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 elementary school students and 6 educators were killed in a mass shooting on December 14, 2012. The speakers in Shelton were mostly local high school students, along with one teacher, and staffers of 2 Connecticut members of the U.S. House of Representatives. House members, and especially the state's 2 senators, Richard Blumenthal and Chris Murphy, have been tireless in working for passage of gun safety measures in Congress, completely without success, until the Valentine's Day massacre of 14 students and 3 staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. That tragic mass shooting paved the way for the passage of modest gun safety measures included in the fiscal year 2018 appropriations bill, which was co-sponsored by Senator Murphy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the Shelton rally and brings us excerpts of talks by 2 students and 1 teacher who spoke there. We hear first from Shelton High School senior, Tyler Monroe.
I am afraid to go to school every day because I overanalyze the goodbyes I say to my mother every morning. And as I walk up to that big brick building, I think over the lines I said in my mind, wondering if they were worthy of being the last words she ever heard me speak. I am afraid to go to school every day because of the plans my classmates and I have made. We hope to go into the military, or perhaps we already send our deposits into our colleges. And I wonder how many of those names on those attendance lists will not be called because those kids did not survive to see this year's autumn. And I should not be afraid to go to school every day because I do not know if I will survive. Students should not walk the halls worrying about the nearest exit in case the PA system announces that there is an armed person in the building. Weapons, do not belong in a building where the sharpest things should be students' minds. I should not be afraid to go to school every day because fear should not meddle with learning. The only worry that should ever exist in such an academic environment is the anxiety for an upcoming test. The information we learn should not be skewed in our minds because we are too worried about the fate of our lives. And I should not be afraid to go to school every day because the path to graduation is so uncertain. Schools across the nation are wondering which one will be next. And school is no place for the fear that my fellow students and I will not live to hear the dismissal bell ring. Thank you.
My name is Caitlin Botsford Tucker, and I am a social studies teacher and a mom. I'm so glad to be speaking to you today, but I am saddened by the reason for this march and the marches taking place across the country. 32 lives at Virginia Tech. One was a friend of mine. 26 lives at Newtown. 17 lives at Stoneman Douglas. The Department of Defense reports that the number of children killed by gunfire in the United States since 2012 surpasses the total number of American soldiers killed overseas in combat since 9/11. Last week, 7,000 pairs of shoes were placed on the U.S. Capitol lawn to represent those lives. Today, students across the country are making it clear that they won't stand for inaction. They are making it clear that they want common sense gun legislation to make sure these tragedies stop. But it isn't easy. Students like Julia and Tyler know this. All the students here need to know it too. It's never easy. It's never easy to speak out when you see something wrong in the world. But you have to. Because democracy is not a spectator sport. Movements are made up of moments. And you should know that this moment is important in this movement. Did you ever think you would be part of a movement? Because you are. You've organized, you've brought us all here, and you've made your voices heard. In my profession, we tell kids to believe in themselves. We tell kids to stand up for their beliefs. We tell kids to care about their community and the people in it. I'm standing here in awe of how well these students have listened. And I know that this is only just the beginning of what you can do. You're proving that you're up for the challenge. Because even when just two or three gather in the name of justice, there is hope. You are the hope for the future. Your voices will be heard, and you will make a difference. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Colby Tremblay, and I'm a junior from St. Joseph High School in Trumbull. Let's arm our teachers with resources, not weapons. Let's give them the tools they need to teach, not the tools to kill. It is a teacher's job to educate, not to fight for their lives and the lives of their students. So I ask all of you today, do not let this be the end of the conversation. We can be the generation that ends gun violence. We can be the generation that ends school shootings. This is our history. Thank you.
Those were excerpts of talks by students Tyler Monroe and Colby Tremblay and teacher Caitlin Botsford Tucker at the March for Our Lives rally in Shelton, Connecticut, recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Cambridge Analytica, a London-based data analytics firm, which worked on Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, has been the subject of a blizzard of recent news stories, Following revelations that the company harvested 50 million Facebook user profiles and used that information to micro-target voters. The company is owned by right-wing billionaire Robert Mercer, and Trump's former chief strategist Steve Bannon was a founder who also served as vice president. The company partnered with Alexander Kogan, a researcher at Cambridge University, who designed a personality quiz app which Cambridge Analytica paid 270,000 Facebook users to install on their profiles. Data from those who installed the app and their network of Facebook friends was later used to target voters with political advertisements on behalf of Mr. Trump. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Yasha Levine, author of the new book Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Here he examines the charges against Cambridge Analytica and what he believes is the more critical issue of giant social media companies' unregulated collection of personal data that is used to make billions in profit.
No matter how scummy these guys at Cambridge Analytica are, and they are scummy, there's no doubt about that. What the company does, taking data on people and using it to help shape elections and influence elections, on behalf of some kind of client, usually a political campaign or a wealthy donor of some kind, what they do is no different than countless other political data-driven election companies do, right? This is very normal in this day and age to use these kinds of techniques, these kinds of psychological profiling, psychometrics, using data pulled from social media, right, and using that data with other data they pull from voter files, from third-party data brokers, from the candidate's own donor lists that they compile. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and various elements within those parties have their own companies that do this kind of stuff. You know, Charles Koch, for instance, lavishly funds, which is basically his own data-driven election influence outfit called I360. As bad as Cambridge Analytica is, it's just one of many players that are very similar, and it's not even the biggest. Well, the kind of data that Cambridge Analytica can pull or had pulled on 50 million Americans pales in comparison to the kind of information that Facebook itself has on those people. We have to remember that Facebook is in the business of surveilling its users, right, compiling profiles on its users, and then selling access to those users to advertisers and to anyone who wants to buy ads on their network for the purpose of influencing their decisions, right? To influencing them to buy a certain product or influencing them to vote for a certain candidate.
Tell us a bit of what we might not fully understand about the business model of Google, Facebook, any number of applications that we put on our smartphones, the games that we play, our cell phones and the use of cell phones on a daily basis. What is going on with our unregulated collection of personal data by these companies, how it's sold, and what are the negative consequences beyond annoying ads that might appear as you're browsing the internet? What are some of the consequences you're concerned about regarding this unregulated collection of our data?
Companies like Google, for instance. Google mediates a huge chunk of our digital life. We carry, a lot of us, 70% of the phone market, if not more, is dominated by Android, the mobile operating system. So 70% of, 7 out of 10 of people who have a mobile phone carry Google in their pocket, right? And Google goes with them wherever they go. And Google also mediates their phone calls, knows who's calling you. It mediates their web browsing, so it knows exactly the websites that you go to. It knows what you're searching for. A lot of people have Gmail, so they're emailing everything, right? They're emailing with their friends, with their colleagues, with their business partners, with their doctor, with their psychiatrist, with their bank, right? All that data, all the attachments in your emails are being scanned, are being monitored, and are being used to compile profiles on you that's being constantly updated. Down to extremely personal information between you and your doctor. Google can know things that you don't even really put into the box. And so the level of information and the intimacy of that information that companies like Google, but also Facebook, because Facebook can collect much of the same information as long as you have the Facebook app running on your phone. The level and intimacy of that information is just kind of stunning. To even just think about that, it's very frightening to know that giant corporations like these can collect that information. And there are no limits on what they can do with that information or what they can collect. There are no regulations. There are no laws that limit or direct in any way the information that they collect on us. It's stunning, but it's true. You know, you don't have to really think too hard about why this is troubling, right? Because while companies like Facebook and Google have been able to sell a progressive side of themselves, to cloak themselves in this progressive image, that they are these companies that are really, you know, only want the best for the world and are trying to make the world a better place. And the truth is, they are, you know, giant profit-seeking corporations like any other. They're really no different than Coke Industries or Philip Morris or ExxonMobil in the sense that they are giant corporations that want to bend society and the political systems in which they exist to their will so they can make more money. And I think in a democratic society, no one should have that kind of power over the democratic process.
Europe has recently moved to something they call a GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation Plan. Are there any similar moves here in the U.S., and what, in your view, should that regulation consist of?
It's a good question. You know, I've been actually trying to understand what this GDPR, you know, I don't know if I can fully comment on that. But look, there are no moves in America. I mean, the closest thing that's happening now to regulating Silicon Valley and its for-profit surveillance business is what's called the Honest Ads Act. It's an important piece of legislation, I think, but it's very limited in that sense. It only applies to election and election advertising. But other than that, there's really nothing. There are no limits on what Silicon Valley can collect, the information they can collect on you.
That was Yasha Levine, author of the new book titled Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Learn more about growing concern regarding internet advertising companies' unregulated collection of personal data by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.